This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Friday, March 1st. I'm John Wanamaker. Minnesota's financial picture got a little bit brighter yesterday with the release of a new economic forecast. State officials announced that the projected budget deficit lawmakers must solve this session has shrunk to $627 million, down from $1.1 billion back in November. Republicans urged Democrats to now abandon their proposals to increase taxes and spending, but as Tim Pugmire reports, DFL Governor Mark Dayton wasn't ready to back off any of his earlier plans.
After crafting a two-year budget based on the early forecast, Governor Dayton said he was surprised to see a more than 40% reduction in the projected deficit. That's a $463 million improvement. Dayton said he plans to release a revised budget proposal within a couple of weeks, but he would not say if it might include any changes in his proposed expansion of the state sales tax or his income tax increase on the wealthiest Minnesotans.
I don't know what my other options are going to be, and I don't have to assess and talk with others and see what what we think will be most effective to continue the positive track that we're on.
Dayton made it clear he still wants to increase spending on education and other priority areas of the budget. He also announced two new spending proposals, an upfront tax exemption for businesses on equipment purchases and property tax credits for renters. DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach of Cook said he plans to continue down the road of doing significant tax reform this session. Bach said he wants to stabilize the state economy and end the recent cycle of deficits.
I do still think strongly that we have to go through this exercise of tax reform to position Minnesota better in the future. And I strongly support having that conversation. I don't think this even slows that down.
The new forecast also shows a projected positive balance of $295 million in the current biennium. Under law, $290 million of that money will go toward paying back some of the delayed payments to school districts that were part of previous budget deals. That leaves $810 million that the state still owes schools. DFL House Speaker Paul Thiessen of Minneapolis said he wants to finish paying back schools this session in addition to erasing the $627 million budget deficit. Thiessen also stressed that new spending on education, job development, and property tax relief remain top priorities.
I don't think this necessarily changes the amount of investments we need to make necessarily. It may create some more flexibility, but we're going to spend the money we think will make a difference to improve Minnesotans' lives.
Republicans were taking credit for the improved forecast, which they claim is largely due to their fight against tax and spending increases during the past 2 years when they controlled the House and Senate. House Minority Leader Kurt Dowd of Crown said it would be a mistake to change that approach as the economy is recovering. Dowd urged the governor to scrap his budget proposal, not just revise it.
We need a budget that's going to show that our priority is growing Minnesota's economy and creating jobs. The policies the governor has put forth will do exactly the opposite. Taxing middle-class Minnesotans in increased sales taxes, in increased cost for goods, is going to be devastating to Minnesota's economy, and taxing Minnesota's job creators is not going to make Minnesota more competitive. We need the governor to come up with a new budget.
Despite its overall good news, the forecast also showed that the electronic pull tab money needed to pay the state share of a new Viking stadium is falling well short of expectations. Far fewer than expected sites are offering the machines, and the ones that are in place are generating less money than projected. Governor Dayton said the initial projections were considerably off, and now a correction is needed to make up the difference.
We're not at that point yet, but there are fallback revenue sources for the stadium. There's tax surcharge on the suites and another lottery game. So, and we'll work with legislative leaders, hopefully on a bipartisan basis, and see what makes sense to do.
Dayton said efforts will be made to speed up the approval for gaming locations. He said he believes the revenue will be closer to projections by next year. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
And all of the good state budget news has a cloud hovering over it in the form of automatic federal budget cuts. The budget forecasts say the federal spending cuts taking effect today, known as the sequester, threaten relatively few jobs in Minnesota, but political uncertainty continues to be a damper on growth. Reporter Annie Baxter has details.
The job of economists at the Minnesota Office of Management and Budget has become a bit trickier these days. State economist Tom Stinson says he feels like his economic forecasts have to involve a lot of guesswork about political processes, and that's not something he relishes.
Economists work with rational expectations, and it's not exactly clear that expectations in the political process are rational.
Stinson specifically referring to political stalemates over fiscal issues. They include the spending cuts taking effect today, plus a potential federal government shutdown and another battle over raising the federal debt ceiling. In the case of the debt ceiling, Stinson doubts politicians would fail to raise it, so it's not a big threat to economic growth. As for the sequester, or a federal government shutdown, Stinson notes that federal dollars are a much smaller portion of the economy in Minnesota than most other states.
The sequester and government shutdown would be considerable inconvenience to people that are affected, but it's not going to bring the economy to its knees.
Stinson projects that even if the sequester continues through this year, it will cost the state no more than 5,000 jobs. That's about a month's worth of job gains. Still, budget stare-downs in Washington create uncertainty. That's the enemy of economic expansion. Nonetheless, the forecast portrays Minnesota's economy as closing in on recovery from the Great Recession. A variety of economic indicators, ranging from claims for jobless benefits to job vacancies, are at or within sight of pre-recession levels. And the Department of Employment and Economic Development reported yesterday that job vacancies in the final 3 months of last year hit a seven-year high for a fourth quarter. Even housing, once a big drag on the economy, is now helping to boost it. State economic forecasters believe the foreclosure problem in Minnesota is largely past, and they note that as employers add more workers and more Minnesotans look to buy homes, just about all the excess housing inventory in the market will clear this year. Remodelers, who are part of the housing industry, also could get a boost.
I honestly think people have grown tired of sitting on the sidelines. I just think we've kind of turned a corner emotionally.
Todd Bierstead does design work and project management for McDonald Remodeling. He says business was up considerably in 2012, including expensive projects like additions.
Sometimes it may be a $30,000 or $40,000 addition, and there are times where if you're doing like two or three levels to a home, it could be well into the several hundred thousand dollar addition.
But even as housing takes off, it's not enough to fuel robust job growth across the state. Total employment in Minnesota is expected to grow modestly and, in fact, slower than was forecast last November. Still, payrolls in Minnesota could get back to their pre-recession peak by the end of the year.
That's reporter Annie Baxter, and Minnesota's members of Congress are mostly back here and not in Washington trying to undo those $85 billion in cuts and members of both parties describe as harmful. Minnesota Public Radio's Washington-based reporter Brett Neely has the story on how we got here and what comes next.
These cuts were never meant to happen. Let's go back in time to 2011. There was a nasty brawl between the White House and congressional Republicans over raising the government's borrowing limit. As a way out of the crisis, Congress came up with two approaches to cut the budget deficit. Plan A was a special committee of lawmakers, the Supercommittee, with extraordinary powers to craft a big deficit reduction deal. Plan B, sequestration, was meant to be so harmful that Congress would be forced to act. In some ways, the sequester was like the atomic doomsday machine from the 1964 movie Dr. Strangelove.
It is not a thing a sane man would do. The doomsday machine is designed to trigger itself automatically.
But surely you can disarm it somehow?
No. It is designed to explode if any attempt is ever made to untrigger it
automatically.
As they do today, Democrats wanted to see higher taxes coupled with spending cuts. Republicans wanted only cuts. The supercommittee failed, and now, 19 months later, no one can defuse the doomsday machine's countdown clock.
So here we are, and it's going to happen.
Colin Peterson, a Democrat who represents the 7th District, voted for the legislation that created the sequester. Peterson would prefer the cuts were replaced by some combination of tax hikes and spending cuts. But unlike most of his colleagues, he's not worried about the cuts' immediate impact.
Well, I don't think it's going to be anywhere near what people are talking about.
Still, the across-the-board nature of the cuts is bad enough that Republicans don't like them either. Here's Representative John Klein, who represents the southern Twin Cities suburbs. He also voted for the sequester.
All of us, I think on both sides of the aisle, agreed that the way the cuts are taken is not good.
Even the delegation's most fiscally conservative member is concerned. That's Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. While she's backed extremely deep spending cuts in the past, she voted against the sequester in 2011. But Bachmann says the Federal Aviation Administration's announcement that it could close air traffic control operations at the St. Cloud Airport in her district could harm plans to launch regular flights from there to Chicago.
This isn't fatal to bringing in a new commercial aircraft to the St. Cloud area, but it's not helpful.
Despite all the complaining about the sequester's impact, the Republican-controlled House has made no effort in this Congress to undo the cuts. You'll often hear House Republicans say they passed two bills to stop the cuts, or as Michelle Bachmann puts it,
because, again, we've already done our work.
But that legislation is from last year. It expired when the new Congress was sworn in January. Instead, the House has spent much of January and February debating minor bills. Republicans, including Klein, blame the Senate for a lack of action.
It is pointless for the House to keep stepping up and passing our alternatives. And what are we supposed to do, just pass a new one every week until it's like a roulette game or something and the ball lands on one they like? No, that's not the way to do legislation.
But a Democratic bill in the Senate that would replace this year's sequester with a mix of spending cuts and tax hikes was blocked by a Republican filibuster on Thursday. President Obama has offered cuts to Social Security and Medicare if Republicans will agree to closing tax loopholes. No deal, says Republican Congressman Eric Paulson, who voted for the sequester. He says the GOP doesn't trust Obama.
Well, from my understanding, many of these things have been mentioned in speeches, for instance, but then when the leaders have gotten together with the president, then he pulls back and withdraws those offers.
The Republican position leaves First District Democrat Tim Walz scratching his head. He voted for the 2011 agreement creating the sequester and says the GOP seems to have decided to let the sequester happen rather than negotiate cuts of the same size that could target ineffective programs and waste.
My Republican colleagues are saying we need to cut the government. They're telling the president, you do it.
Members from both sides of the aisle say the real work on undoing the sequester begins next week. That's when the House begins work on a bill to keep the government running through September. They all believe that measure could be a vehicle for some kind of compromise. But compromise is in short supply in Capitol Hill these days. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Today is the deadline for American Indians and their descendants who wish to take part in a multi-billion-dollar settlement with the federal government to make their claims. In Minnesota, some $57 million is being distributed to more than 35,000 tribal members. It's part of a $3.4 billion settlement over the federal government's poor management of money and land owned by American Indians. Conrad Wilson reports.
Last month, Arlene Weas called the Bureau of Indian Affairs. She filed her claim to be counted among the thousands of American Indians around the country taking part in the Cobell settlement, named after a member of Montana's Blackfeet tribe who sued the federal government over its accounting practices related to tribal lands. Weas has lived on the Mille Lacs Reservation in central Minnesota for the last 54 years and says for her, the settlement brings closure.
The federal government has said that, yes, we did this. We admit our mistakes, and we'll accept that now.
But not so, Weas says, for some of her immediate family members who may not get a settlement check. First, a look at the story behind the settlement. More than 125 years ago, the federal government divided up reservations, gave that land to individual tribal members, and proceeded to manage it on behalf of those tribal owners, including revenues generated from timber sales and mining. The money was managed in individual Indian accounts. But the government did a bad job. A really bad job. The lawsuit aimed to expose that by asking for a complete accounting of individual tribal members' accounts. In 2009, the federal government and plaintiffs announced a $3.4 billion settlement. It's divided up into three parts. $1.9 billion will consolidate lands and return them to tribal ownership. That part is just getting underway. $60 million is set aside for an American Indian College Scholarship Fund, and nearly $1.5 billion is to make right the accounting problems. And that's where today's deadline comes in. Already, more than 200,000 tribal members nationwide have received a $1,000 check if they have ownership in land that's generating income. Other tribal members may have an account, but don't necessarily own land that's generating income. Under the settlement, those tribal members are eligible for at least $800, but they need to file a claim with the Bureau of Indian Affairs by the end of the day.
Those folks have to make sure they raise their hand to get those payments.
David Hayes is Deputy Secretary for the Interior Department. He says those members are eligible because it's possible the government could have done more to help make the land profitable.
The historical attention the United States government paid to these individual Indian interests for which we have a trust responsibility, that historical attention was less than ideal. And we acknowledge that. We want to provide compensation for that. We want to turn the page.
Despite the government's willingness to right its wrongs, the process hasn't been without confusion. That brings us back to Arlene Weas of the Mille Lacs Band. She says she's spoken to most of her family about the settlement.
There's about 40 adults in my family, just my immediate family, and there's probably 12 right now that are going to get a compensation. So what happened to the other 28?
The Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe's Assistant Commissioner for Administration, Michelle Palamaki, says there are similar stories across the reservation of some family members getting checks while others aren't.
Some are being told your name has to be on the paperwork, and some may be told it doesn't if you can list off family members who've received a check. We've heard that even, that you can you tell us what family members, and you make a list of that, and that's how they kind of track you down too. But that's not said to every one of us.
Despite the confusion, Palamaki says the settlement represents a positive step. She says it's dollars that will come back to band members.
They will use that as they see fit, whether it's for themselves or for their families. And it's positive in the sense that, again, this brings closure. It's a good end to a chapter in our Native American history.
Last April, the Obama administration announced a separate $1 billion settlement. It, too, resolved century-old accounting disputes for tribal dollars that were mismanaged by the federal government. The main difference in that settlement is the money went to tribes. Conrad Wilson, Minnesota Public Radio News, on the Mille Lacs Indian Reservation.
In his annual State of the University speech, U of M President Eric Kaler cautioned against placing too much faith in online education. Alex Friedrich has more.
This spring, the U will offer several massive open online courses that can teach tens of thousands of students at the same time. But Kaler cautioned that they're not a silver bullet for saving money or improving access. He cited Carlson School of Management Dean Sri Zahir, who calls such trendy ideas the fast food of higher education.
She asked, and I'll quote, "What nourishment are you missing out when you get a Big Mac instead of a three-course meal?"
Kaler suggested the so-called three-course meal is an education on campus that uses technology but retains the face-to-face relationship between professor and student.
That's education reporter Alex Friedrich. An Iron Range mining company has scuttled a plan to reroute a major highway over an active open-pit mine. MnDOT is required to relocate Highway 53 between Eveleth and Virginia so United Taconite can expand the mine. One popular reroute would have traveled over the operating mine, but the mine's parent company says no. Cliffs Natural Resources spokeswoman Sandy Karnowski says the company has told MnDOT it can't support that option.
We've been pretty open about some of our concerns, particularly on the environmental issue. We had concerns that we could operate in compliance with air quality regulations if there was a four-lane highway through our pit.
Karnowski says the company was also concerned about public safety and operational challenges. The second leading option would route the highway over an old mine pit now filled with water east of Virginia. MnDOT says it's still on schedule to move the highway by 2017. Wisconsin revenue officials are considering adding $30 scratch-off tickets. Lottery officials say the tickets do well in other states and could bring in more revenue. According to its website, the Minnesota Lottery sells a $30 scratch-off ticket called the $1 Million Jackpot. Odds are 1 in 5 with that $1 Million jackpot that you'll get your $30 back. That's the NPR News Update for Friday, March 1st. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.